Chris Guillebeau has written a book based on his award-winning blog. The book is The Art of Nonconformity, and he's a writer, he's a traveler, and a self-described fighter of the status quo. He thinks we could all change the world if we just stopped conforming to it. Of course, there's got to be a few leaps of faith along the way. And that's what Chris is coming up for next, to explain to you how easy it can be for you to live a life of nonconformity and what you might be possible, what might be capable, you might be capable of doing tonight if you decided to commit yourself to nonconformity. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Chris Guillebeau has an interesting career and an interesting career goal, I would add. He is on a journey, although I'm tired of that word, to visit every country in the world before his 35th birthday in 2012. When he's not traveling, he lives in Portland, Oregon. Good evening, Chris.
Good evening, Ian. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yep, Chris Guillebeau, the author of The Art of Nonconformity, which, as I traveled around the web a little bit, sussing your book out, it occurs to me that it's had a couple of different subtitles before, or at least things that it's been known for. But the current aim of the book is to challenge us to think outside the box, the art of nonconformity. It's to learn all the ways in which we could transform our life to be more in keeping with what our inner voice is calling us to do. Fair enough to say?
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. It was originally called A Brief Guide to World Domination. And then, the blog is called The Art of Nonconformity. So we decided just to name the book after the blog. But I still like the world domination theme as well.
Yeah, well, I get that, and I think that may have been a little high concept for some people to get their head around. But then
Yes,
I then
it was quite a discussion.
yeah, and then the art of nonconformity, unconventional strategies for life, work, and travel. Is that the subtitle for the blog?
That is correct, yes. And for
Okay.
the book, it's Set Your Own Rules, Live the Life You Want, and Change the World.
Okay, so it's like just to, all we have to say is the art of nonconformity. That's the only thing people have to remember. And you'll find the
Right.
book somewhere. You can link up to him through coasttocoastam.com. But how close are you to realizing your goal of visiting every country on the planet by 2012?
Well, I've got 151 countries down so far. I've been doing this for about 10 years, so I've made a lot of good progress, but I still have about 40 countries to go. I'm using the United Nations list of countries, so there's 192 countries in total. So I still have about 40 to go. And the thing is, it gets progressively more difficult as I go along. I run out of easy countries. I used to be able to go around the world, and I would get five new countries. Now it's like, I'm going to the South Pacific to get one country. I'm going all the way to Central Asia to get, Turkmenistan or something like that. So it's getting progressively more difficult, but so far so good.
How hard is it to get into all of these countries?
Most of them are not that difficult. Most of them with a U.S. passport or a Canadian passport or European passport, it's not so difficult. I would say probably half of the countries in the world are very easy to get to. Then you've got another group of countries that you need to have a visa for, so it takes some time. Sometimes you can get that visa upon arrival. Sometimes you have to work with the embassy in advance. So that's another group. And then it's probably only a final group of about 20 to 30 countries that really are difficult, to get permission to enter, just to find flights to get to. I've been trying to get to as many of those difficult countries along the way so that I'm not saving them off at the end. But
Right.
I do still have a big group, of countries that are going to be a challenge.
Which will be the hardest country for you to get into, do you think?
That's a good question. I would say, it's probably like 5 to 10 countries that are difficult, and it'll be interesting to see which one is the hardest. In terms of dangerous countries, there's not actually that many dangerous countries in the world. I mean, most places are very safe, but there are a few. So Somalia, is a difficult and dangerous country. North Korea, of course, is difficult, to get permission to go to. Afghanistan is difficult. Iran is difficult. But it's not all difficult for political reasons. There are also some countries like in the South Pacific, like in Africa, like in Central Asia, that are just kind of hard to get to. Like it takes a long time to, get to a hub where you're going to fly to that place, or they only have flights once a week. you know, that kind of thing. So
right.
It's a fun little challenge. It's something that I really, really enjoyed. It's been very meaningful to me, and I'm so grateful that I've been able to do it.
Again, we're talking about the art of nonconformity. We'll get more into that coming up in just a second. But you mentioned Somalia. Somalia is in the news along with Portland. In that there was this story that came out in the last 2 days about an FBI sting operation which caught a young naturalized U.S. citizen from Somalia that was intending to blow up the lighting of the Christmas tree in downtown Portland, and had a bomb that was in, or thought he had a bomb that had been created by these FBI plants that was really a dummy bomb, but it got so far as to the point where he was hitting the detonator, nothing happened, and that's when they made the arrest. What is your world experience as a traveler, and then also as, you know, at least for the last couple of years, as a citizen of Portland, what do you hear in that story that the rest of us don't hear?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was just reading the news about that this morning, and I'm actually home in Portland right now. I've been on book tour for the past couple months, but during Thanksgiving, I'm home. So that happened just a couple miles, you know, from my home, and just got to read the news. And I guess I'm not sure if I read anything that different from anyone else. I guess I just think about identity and disillusionment and why would this person do this? You know, this person who is, he is Somali, but then he's also American, and he's been here in Oregon for some time. And we think of Oregon, at least a lot of us do, as a kind of a tolerant, you know, place, a kind of a welcoming place. So we think, you know, why would somebody do this? And I guess, you know, maybe in time we'll have the answers to that, but perhaps we won't as well, because it's kind of a strange thing. So, I mean, it's unfortunate that this happened, but it's good, of course, that it wasn't any worse than it could have been.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. But while I'm reading your book, I'm hearing that news story, and the thought occurred to me is, why aren't we thinking of that guy as a nonconformist?
Why aren't we thinking of him as a nonconformist? Well,
yeah.
I guess the difference is, yeah, sure. I guess the difference is, you know, he's a nonconformist who intends to cause harm. So I think that's probably the difference. You know, I guess I'm interested in connecting with people, you know, as nonconformity as a force for good. You know, nonconformity as a way to change the world for the better. So, of course, if you're going to blow a bomb off, that's going to change the world, no doubt about it. But I guess I would put the parameter down and say, like, a positive force for change, or a change, you know, a force for good.
Well, then good thing you dropped the original subtitle about world domination.
Perhaps.
I'm not being intentionally obnoxious when I push you on that, but it's curious to me, because I think we have to have a line between nonconformity and anarchy. How do you draw that line in your own head?
I guess the first thing would be to ask, you know, are you causing harm? The first rule of international development, you know, I worked overseas in West Africa for about 4 years. The first rule of international development is do no harm. Whatever you do, make sure you're not harming someone. And then beyond that, I would say, you know, nonconformity is number one about, you know, pursuing a big dream, you know, doing something, going on a quest of some kind, not necessarily a travel quest, but some kind of personal goal that you want to do, while also thinking about, you know, how that goal and how those dreams intersect with the lives of others, and how we're all connected, you know, from where I am in Oregon, from where you are, where the listeners are, with people all over the world. So I guess, you know, I'm trying to tie in nonconformity with a goal of service, but also with, you know, a goal of doing something great for yourself. So I guess I'm trying to integrate a few different things.
No, I love that. But then if nonconformity means dedicating one's self to a form of radical service, or a kind of less traditional understanding of how one can make a living and raise a family and achieve one's personal goals, then what does that say about, what does conformity represent? What do you think are the hallmark traits of conformity?
Well, I would say the central message is, you know, number one, you don't have to live your life the way other people expect you to. Number two, you know, you can do good things for yourself and for others at the same time. It's not a false choice. It's not a dichotomy, you know, and all these different people, you know, that I write about in the book, on the blog, that I'm meeting with as I travel the country, they're all doing that in very, very different ways. So when we talk about conformity, I guess I tend to think of conformity as this kind of, you know, doing things the way they've always been done, doing things the way another generation did, or the way that our peers do. You know, I tell this story in the book. Maybe this makes a little more sense. I tell this story about bridge jumping. And so this experience, like, that you might have had when you were a kid and you wanted to do something that you probably shouldn't do, and your parent or your teacher or some authority figure says, you know, hey, Ian, why do you want to do this? And Ian says, oh, because Chris is doing it, because so-and-so is doing it, because everyone's doing it. And, you know, this person says, well, if everyone else jumped off the bridge, you know, would you? Which is probably good advice when you're a kid. But then the problem is that we grow up and the situation changes and kind of reverses itself. And, you know, we look around and we see that many of our peers are doing the same kind of thing. Many of our peers are making the same decisions in terms of their career, in terms of their education, relationships, how they think about money, how they think about debt, you know, all these kind of things. And so that's where the conformity aspect comes in. And so, you know, what I've observed is if we want to do something different, if we want to kind of pursue our own unconventional life and take the road not taken or even make our own road, then we often encounter resistance. And we often encounter this pressure. And it's almost like everybody's asking us the opposite question. It's almost like everyone is saying, you know, everyone else is jumping off the bridge. You know, why aren't you? What's wrong with you? And so, you know, the reason why I wrote The Art of Nonconformity is to bring the childhood message up to adulthood application. And basically, you know, say what we talked about earlier, you don't have to live your life the way other people expect you to. And it's okay, you know, to step away from the bridge, and it's okay to kind of, you know, create your own road.
By definition, doesn't that mean, though, that the line between what is a conformist and nonconformist changes over time? It can change from generation to generation. It can change from economic group to economic group.
Yes, I would agree completely. I would say it's contextual.
I think there was a time when my wife decided first of all, just getting married can be, oddly enough, at some point getting married is going to be an act of nonconformity.
Sure.
You know, I mean, it sounds weird because we would associate getting marriage as the traditional route.
But if
statistically more young people, you included, find somebody that they love and they travel with and they have a lifetime with and they make a partner, but they won't get married, and that becomes the norm, then the nonconformist route will be marriage.
Right.
Weird, huh?
Right, that's true. Right, it is weird. And so I would say the most important thing is not necessarily to get married or to not get married. I would say the most important thing is to do what you do intentionally, right? Not because other people are doing it, not because, you know, this other generation did it or because this current generation is doing it. But to think, you know, what do you want to get out of a relationship? You know, if you're in love with someone, well, how do you express that love? What kind of commitment are you looking for? And what do you, you know, what are the two of you most comfortable with, right? It's not so much to marry or to not marry.
Right. But I'm just saying there's a million ways that we could look at that, too, that at some point, what is a conformist and what is a nonconformist? For example, I remember when I was in college, there was this whole group of very cool people who all had sported that, you know, all black lower Manhattan look.
Sure.
We used to call them PIBS, the people in black. And they thought of themselves as very nonconformist while they all sat there wearing the exact same thing.
Right, of course.
You know, I always thought that was so funny. They were nonconformists wearing a uniform of nonconformity. All right. Well, the art of nonconformity, though, is so much more than that. And that's and thanks for letting me just kind of play around with it at the beginning, because these are thoughts I was having as I'm reading through the chapters, and I'm trying to look at my own life and see where I'm a conformist and where have I never conformed. And I think it's a great challenge to anybody who thinks that they have a great idea or they think that they're capable of something more than what they're doing. This book is very permissive. You give the kind of encouragement and the kind of paradigm shifting, you know, kind of advice that allows people to see what their life could be like if they had no fear. And then you also lay out some real practical kind of step-by-step blueprinty kind of things and how to get from point A to point B, which I think is also very helpful. So let's pull back a little bit and talk about your life. You've had days of conformity. You've had days where you've been part of a more traditional lifestyle, but most of your life has not been like that.
Sure. No, I think that's fair to say. I would say, maybe a turning point for me was after 9/11, when I was depressed like everybody else. And, you know, prior to that point, I had a relatively conventional life. I mean, I was still self-employed. I kind of like walked away from a job, so we can talk about that at some point. But, like I had a home and, you know, I had a marriage and I still have the same marriage, so that hasn't changed. But, you know, we're just living and just kind of working and not really having much of a goal in our lives other than just kind of, you know, to live life or whatever. And so then 9/11 happened and I was depressed like everybody else and just asking myself the good questions of life, like why am I here and what am I really doing? And so it was out of that experience that ended up moving to West Africa for about 4 years, volunteering for a medical charity. And that was that to me was probably a big turning point in terms of nonconformity, or at least in terms of like helping me see that the world was a bigger place than I had imagined, and helping me see that you know, it wasn't just about, you know, continuing with my career or, you know, doing whatever, but it was about finding a way to do what I want and hopefully in a way that would, you know, benefit other people as well. That was one turning point. I'm sure there are many others we could go into.
Right. But I think right there you discovered the definition difference between a career and a life work.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
Because you used, you know, working on this medical ship, you also make the point that when you went to work for this organization that was providing medical care, that you volunteered there up until the point when it went from replenishing to soul sucking, where there's other people that stayed way too late in that volunteer situation and they were no longer getting the benefit of that experience that you were.
Right. And so I think I said something about the best time to leave the greatest job in the world is right before you get sick of it.
Right.
And that's kind of how I felt, because, like, you know, going to West Africa, I'd never been to Africa before at all, and like went to the poorest country in the world, Sierra Leone, worked there for a year, worked in Liberia for a year, worked in a couple of other countries nearby for 2 more years, so 4 years. And it was a great experience. It was transformative and emotional and felt like I was just, you know, making a difference, but also being changed myself and transformed. So it was great all around. And then towards the end, I just kind of noticed that I was, you know, being distracted and maybe I wasn't as engaged as I should have been. So that was the time to kind of step away and say, you know, this is not a place to be. You know, if you're not 100% committed, if you're not 100% engaged, I don't want to be in this situation. Because as you say, like, I could see some other people who had just kind of stayed beyond because you know, as weird as it sounds, it became normal to them. You know, it
right.
became normal to them because that's what they had done, you know, for 5 years or 10 years or whatever. And that was the only reason they had to do it, because they couldn't imagine for any other possibility. So in a way, I mean, it was almost a little bit scary to relocate back to the States, you know, after doing that for 4 years, because that kind of became natural and normal. But that was, you know, in a way, that was the growth process, you know, that I needed to have. Like, I needed to come back to the States and pursue something different just because I wasn't, you know, I wasn't fully engaged. And I'm so glad I did, because those experiences overseas were great. But now, you know, like, I'm also having a great time doing what I'm doing now.
Right. And we'll talk about that and how people listening to us could find themselves becoming a professional writer in, what was it, 276 days? What was your number?
Yeah, like 279 days to overnight
okay.
success.
Yeah, 279. But there you go. All right, we'll get more to that coming up. And Chris Guillebeau is the author of The Art of Nonconformity. But before I switch from that topic, you know, I'll say I know a lot of people that work in the not-for-profit sector who are very frustrated with it,
right.
or become frustrated with it over time, because not-for-profit becomes sort of a synonym for not for action.
Right, which is unfortunate, but true.
Yeah, and that they, you know, the especially when it comes to charitable organizations where people are volunteering their time, there's no, without the profit motive, without an incentive on, you know, that time equals money, it can get to the point where sometimes just nothing really gets done. And some of my friends who work in that environment in not-for-profit, they love it when they partner with a corporation, because the corporate people get it done. I mean, they just move along and they find that so refreshing. And they go to a meeting where something really happens in a meeting really fast, and then they're doing it, and then it's over, and then they kind of go back to sometimes just kind of drifting along. So nonconformity can mean lots of different things to different people. What will it mean to you? We'll explain this coming up next, how it is you can identify what's wrong with your life, and then what are going to be some of the simple first couple of steps you can take to better realizing your full potential. Chris Guillebeau has written about this a lot. He's got a blog up on it. You can link up to his webpage, through coasttocoastam.com. Grab this book. It's going to make a great gift to somebody who's looking at 2011 and not liking what they're seeing yet. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. I'm going to ask Chris Guillebeau, coming up in just a second, to give us a quick test. He's got a couple of exercises in the book. How can we tell if we're being a conformist? How we can tell if we've got an inner voice of a nonconformist that's telling us to do something? And then what are some of the first couple of steps we can take to get from where we are to where we would really love our life? Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Chris Guillebeau is the author of The Art of Nonconformity. So, as somebody who had flirted with a more conventional life at one point before opting out and continuing to push the envelope of what it means to be a nonconformist in our American culture and the world today, what would you say would be some of the identifying traits? If you wanted people to take a moment, take a breath, and think about whether or not they're living a life that is not suited to them, are there exercises or is there some sort of mental image you can get them to work with in order to better understand whether they fit the life they're living?
You know, I'm a big fan of just encouraging people to think about motivations and think about why they do what they do. I like this quote from Martin Luther King Jr. He said, nothing pains some people more than having to think. And so I think, the more that we can think about this question, why do you do what you do? You know, I have this image that I used to have on my laptop every time I'd open up my computer, and it's this big picture of a sign, and it says, why do you do this every single day? It was just a good reminder, like, okay, what's the point? What am I doing? And so, you know, as you said before the break, I'm not judgmental. I'm not trying to, you know, get anyone to change the way they think. I guess I'm just, you know, trying to get people to think about, you know, why they do what they do. And so the first thing that I always, ask people about when they're trying to, you know, maybe make the jump to something different or think about living unconventionally, whatever that means for them. You know, I always ask them, like, okay, are you doing what you want to do? Is there something that you've always wanted to do that you, maybe when you were a kid, you were discouraged from doing that, you kind of, you know, got into something else later? What excites you? What bothers you? You know? And then when you think about things that excite you, how can you do something to get closer to that every day? What's one thing you can do to get closer to that, whether that's some kind of small business thing, whether it's a travel thing, whether it's something completely different, just how can you begin to make a small change towards that? And then I think, in the book, I have a list of 11 ways to be unremarkably average. I think that's the kind of thing about, when you are a conformist, I think some of them are something like accept what people tell you at face value, don't question authority, go to college because you're supposed to, not because you want to actually learn something, you know, that kind of thing. So basically, I would say all those things are just kind of doing things because that's the way they've been done, as opposed to doing something because you want to do it.
And yet I was hinting at the model that you use, that you do personally or talk about, which is if you were going to imagine a different life, to write it all out, you know, start from the moment you got up in the morning until you went to bed at night and describe what would be your perfect life.
Right. So that would be like that's the classic ideal day exercise, you know, just as you say, like, what time do you wake up in the morning? What do you eat for breakfast? Is anybody there with you? Okay, after breakfast, what do you do? You know, how do you spend your day? What kind of work do you do? Do you work at all? Do you do something different? You know, how do you spend your free time? Where do you live? You know, and just thinking about those things in as much detail as possible. I mean, just spending a couple of hours, you know, journaling, you know, or if you prefer to dictate it somehow, just whatever creative way you want to get it out. Just kind of imagining what your, you know, ideal day or ideal life would look like, and not putting restrictions on yourself, not thinking, oh, that's not possible because I've got this other thing or whatever, but just kind of imagining, you know, what you would like it to be like. And then, as I say, just making very small changes, you know, over time to kind of align yourself with that day that you've imagined. Even starting with something that might seem very trivial in the beginning can often have a big impact later on.
When I'm working with young people like yourself, when I'm talking to people who are just trying to find their what they think their life path might be like, I say to them, and I recommend this to everybody except for people who are driving, close your eyes and just imagine a canvas. You have a perfectly white, large canvas, and then just without self-criticism, you know, silence the inner critic. Right. Just look at that canvas and picture on it exactly what you would be doing, what you would be wearing, where you would be if you had no fear. And I find that, you know, there's a lot of people who will say the first thing that comes to their mind often surprises them and often scares them, because it's the thing they want to do the most, but they're so far from it.
Well, it can be uncomfortable. I think it can be uncomfortable to think about those things, especially if you've suppressed them, you know, before, or you know, if something happened to you when you were younger, when you wanted to do something unconventional, but you kind of got pushed into a more conventional track. I think when that comes up again, then it's a little bit uncomfortable, because maybe we think about, oh, you know, something that we've missed before, or maybe we realize, you know, that the track we're on is not the track that we want to be on. So it can be discomforting, but I think hopefully in the end, you know, it's a positive thing.
Gotta be, but you have to have some place to start. And the exercise you give about, you know, take a couple hours, but literally write out in great detail what your life would be like. You got up in the morning, and would you walk the dog in a 20-acre backyard while you thought big thoughts, drinking a cup of coffee? Would you get up first thing, put on track shoes, and run through the downtown while other people were going to work? Whatever it is, you have to you have to know what your life would be like in your own perfect world in order for you to be able to, you know, to tack the sails to get you going in that direction.
Right, exactly. I think somebody said once there's only two problems in life: not knowing what you want and not knowing how to get it. You obviously have to solve the first problem first. You have to know what you want. You have to know what you want to work for. Otherwise, you know, there's not much you can do.
Well, and you got to feel like you have a right to do it. And that's the other piece that so many times people feel like they don't have a right to be happy, or they don't have a right to do what they want. That may be because of how they were brought up religiously. It might have to do with, you know, parents' inhibitions and feeling like if they couldn't get what they wanted, you know, they, in very subtle ways, they make it seem like their kids shouldn't get what they want either.
Right, right.
Yeah. Now, the other piece of this would be like the 5-year plan. Talk about your 5-year planning. How you do that?
Yeah, I just started doing this a few years ago. Actually, while I was in Africa, I just kind of after I had done the exercise about the ideal day, I wanted to kind of take it a little bit further and think, okay, not only do I want to think about how I want my ideal day to look like, I want to think about, you know, what I'm working towards over time, you know, that 3 to 5 year period. And so that's when I thought, okay, you know, looking 3 to 5 years out, you know, what do I want to have accomplished, you know, during that time? And I think I had been to maybe 50 countries by then, and I thought, well, you know, I'd like to try to get to 100 countries. So I wrote that down, you know, let's get to 100 countries. I wanted to run a marathon. Like, I'd always run, you know, a little bit, you know, 3 to 5 miles, but I'd never run any long distance. So I wrote marathon down, you know. I was planning on relocating back to the States. I wanted to go to grad school and get a master's degree. I just started writing all these different goals down. And again, not censoring myself. I'm kind of going to that blank slate you were talking about, just putting down anything I could think of and saying like, okay, you know, how can I put this in the 3 to 5 year goal list? And then from there, let's go back to the ideal day and think, what do I need to do, you know, to connect these two things? You know, if I want to achieve these things in 3 to 5 years, if I want to run a marathon next year, well, I have to kind of get on some kind of training program now. You know, I have to get the right running shoes. I have to make sure I'm, you know, staying relatively healthy, those kind of things. If I'm going to visit 50 countries over the next 3 to 5 years, well, I'm going to need to do at least, you know, 10 countries a year. And how can I make that work? So just trying to connect the two different processes.
Well, and you ask a slightly different question, too. You ask, what would you do if you knew you could not fail?
I think, I mean, that's an interesting question. And I also think, you know, a lot of us have a fear of failure, and we also have a fear of success, which is a different issue. But I think a lot of us are worried about, you know, I don't want to set a goal because what if I fail? You know, I really want to do this, but if I formalize this, if I put this out there and say, I want to run the marathon, you know, if I don't run the marathon, right, then I will feel like I've failed, and therefore maybe it's better just to not set the goal, right? But I think over the long term, you're going to have more discomfort from that. I think over the long term, you know that you wanted to run the marathon or whatever it is you wanted to do. So it's probably better to formalize that and say, yes, I want to do this. What do I need to do, you know, to make that happen? What kind of changes do I need to make in my life to make that easier?
But the again, that comes down to permission. You have to be able to give yourself permission, maybe not to do it all at once, but to do it in little increments. And as you go across the country and talk, I know people come up to you and say, I want to live your life.
Sometimes they do, Ian, and I try to always, you know, put that back on them. And I always say, well, let's not think about my life so much, but let's talk about your life and what is it that you want to do, right? So when we think about permission, you know, I always try to be really clear. I'm not a guru of any kind. I'm not trying to give people permission because I can't do that. I don't have that kind of authority, and no one does. I think what people need to do is find a way to give themselves permission, you know? And so that's where, I mean, empowerment is kind of an overused, overrated word, but I think that really is what it is. It's helping people, you know, helping people find a way to create permission for themselves as opposed to looking to someone else to give them a permission slip. You know, that's not going to happen. No one's going to come along and say, Ian, here's your permission slip, you know, go and be a nonconformist. But to help people think, okay, you know, here's one guy who's done something that might be interesting to some people. Other people don't care about it. That's fine. But what is it that I want to do? You know, what's my big dream? And how can I find a way to make that happen? And if they can take something from what I've done and apply it to their life, then that's great. That's wonderful.
Okay, but I think you actually do that. I think you are writing permission slips. It doesn't mean they leave the classroom. It doesn't mean they go out in the hallway. But you, by laying out simple steps on how to get from point A to point B, you are doing that. You're saying you can, you have a right to. That in itself is permissive to a lot of people who have been told through society or through their own inner voices that they are not allowed to do what they want. That somehow being an adult is equated with not doing what you want.
Right, right. Sure. No, I think that's fair. I think that's fair. I just want to make the distinction, you know, that ultimately it's going to be up to people, you know, to make their own choices and to make the changes in their life that they want to make. And so if they succeed doing that, it's not because of me. It's because of something that they've done. And so often people, I think, are attracted to the art of nonconformity, to my side or the book or whatever. I think they're attracted when they're already inclined, you know, toward making some kind of change. So I don't think necessarily that this project is a catalyst so much as it is like an amplifier. I think there are lots of people that you know, wanting to live unconventionally, lots of people that are trying to do something different. And so not just my story, but other people's stories that I write about, I think there is some encouragement in that. I think, you know, I do hear from a lot of people who say, I read this site because then I don't feel alone. You know, my friends, my family, they think I'm crazy because I want to do something different. But then I go on this site and I read there's a whole, you know, big community of other people, you know, who are doing something unconventional. So that helps me, you know, it just helps me feel like there's other people out there like me. So I think that's right.
Right. Right. We're talking with Chris Guillebeau about the art of nonconformity. All right. How does one create a list of one's own values? You know, values by which they want to live that they may or may not be living by at the time.
Sure. I guess, it's the same kind of brainstorming process that we talked about in terms of the goals. There's all kinds of good values and virtues and things out there, but, you know, we have to make a choice at some point. We have to prioritize. So I would say it's a question of thinking about what's most important to us and, thinking about, you know, how have we benefited from other people before in the past, and how have we helped people? You know, how can we be generous? And in terms of values, I mean, maybe it's easy to talk about the ones that I've chosen, and then we can talk about anybody else's. But for me, I've chosen freedom and independence, just kind of as my highest values. As an entrepreneur, as a self-employed person, I've always like decided I want to work for myself, no matter what. Even if I could maybe make more money or have more security in a job somewhere, I would still probably choose to be self-employed because I value freedom and independence, you know, so much. And then my second primary goal is gratitude. I feel like, you know, I've been very fortunate to do what I have done. I've been very fortunate to be able to travel and to work overseas and, you know, now to write this book and do this. So I want to try to express gratitude, you know, throughout my life, however I can do that and whatever, you know, whatever means I can do that. So those are a few. I think I have a list of them at some point.
Yeah. And in the book. Now, but okay, so let's go over what, like, the way that you started to become an entrepreneur. It's very simple. It almost sounds like something like they sell for, you know, for $149 on the internet.
What was
you
that?
Know what I mean?
What was the $149?
Well, you know, like, you watch these late night infomercials, or you'll see these pop-ups on when you're online that say, you know, buy this package, buy these cassette tapes, learn to, you know, become an online entrepreneur.
Sure.
And you did exactly that, and you just did it entirely on your own. Explain how you did it.
Yeah, so this is a very good transition, because it's important to point out that my you know, my jump into entrepreneurship was not motivated by, you know, anything that was really higher level. And then my main motivation was, I don't want to work a job for someone else. Like, I do not want to be an employee. I am not a good employee. I don't like, you know, a fixed schedule. I want to do my own thing. And so that was my motivation in the beginning. And so the way it worked for me, I was about 20 years old, and I was working at FedEx in Memphis, Tennessee. I was working the third shift. So I'd work 4 to 5 hours, you know, through the middle of the night, carrying boxes around. I would make about $8 an hour or whatever. And so then I heard about this new website called eBay.com. This was about 10 years ago. And I just, you know, I looked around my apartment and I put some things up for sale. So I was selling things from my apartment, and I had never done this before. I didn't really know how to do it, but I put it online, and then the thing sold the next week, and I found out that I'd made about $22 or $25 an hour. And I was like, well, this is great. You know, $25 an hour versus $8 an hour working in the middle of the night for somebody else. And so I left FedEx and I never went back, and just kind of kept doing that. And eventually I ran out of things around my apartment to sell. So I had to find another source of, you know, goods for sale. So I started importing coffee. I found a distributor in Jamaica, and I imported coffee to the U.S. and sold it to, you know, to other distributors and wholesalers. Then I learned how to do web design, and I learned how to do affiliate marketing and information products and all these kind of things. But the whole transition was really motivated in the beginning by just like, how can I do something to create my own freedom? How can I do something to where maybe I'm not going to be a millionaire, I'm not going to start a huge business or whatever, but I don't have to work for someone else. So that's kind of where it got started, you know, and 10 years on, you know, I'm still working for myself.
Yeah, and I think that this is very good, and the fact that you were able to do that pretty easily without having to buy one of these, you know, DVD collections or whatever, or
go to
a seminar somewhere in a Holiday Inn, you know, and nothing wrong with that if you are one of the few people who can turn around and actually, you know, do those sorts of things. But you don't need to have a seminar or, you know, a famous person on a DVD telling you. You can go out, you can create something, you can find your own market, you can take your own chances. It's kind of the beauty of our system here in the United States. I would imagine in a lot of countries, and probably most of the countries you visit, you might not have been able to do that.
That is exactly correct. I think that is something that's very good about the United States, that entrepreneurship is encouraged, and it's very easy to become an entrepreneur. It's and you can start a business now. In most states, you can go online and pay about $40 for a business license, and you can have it instantly, you know, or within a day or two, whereas lots of countries in the world, it may take 30 or 50 steps and 30 or 50 days or much longer, and lots of money and sometimes even bribes and, you know, all kinds of things just to be even allowed to operate a business. So, no, I definitely think that is a huge benefit of living in the United States.
Right. And even the idea of being able to buy products cheaply and be able to resell them, like your coffee business from Jamaica, you know, you kind of freelanced that. There wasn't anybody that was doing it before you.
Right.
And somebody didn't come to you and say, hey, here's a way to do it.
Sure. And I was just going to say, like, in terms of permission, I wasn't thinking, like, who's going to give me permission to do this? You know, I just kind of found a way to do it. But again, if I wasn't living in the United States, I might not have thought that. I mean, you know, many other places, I would have had to have sought permission, you know, from some government source or, you know, some other source to even be able to consider doing that. So yes, definitely fortunate to have that.
Okay. But necessity was the mother of invention on that, wasn't it?
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
So, you know, you were, and that's what we'll get into coming up next. The stories of both in your own experience and other people that with whom you've come in contact who were forced into by economic changes, by crushing boredom, by self-realization. They were forced into making a change into their lifestyle and to become a nonconformist. We'll talk about that. The ones that did it successfully and the ones that did it unsuccessfully. Because we're talking to people tonight who are listening, who are thinking they've got an idea. They've got a life they want to live. They're on a path which maybe that provides a certain amount of financial security, but maybe not. And they're wishing, they're hoping that they could live a different life. Well, you can, but you've got to start by realizing that if you don't do it now, then when? And if you don't do it, who's going to make you? So what will life be like for you coming up in just a second? Keep going with this. What's that thing that you've got inside of you? What's that idea? What's that life that you want to lead? We're going to explore that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.